Good evening. Welcome to all of you. We are glad that you're here. As always, we frequently mention how happy we are to see other people. I hope that never just sounds like a stale stock greeting. It is very good to see people who are interested in serving God, people that we love, people that we love being with. Thank you all for coming and worshiping with us tonight. You can be finding in your Bibles Nehemiah chapter 4, if you would, please. We're going to be taking the bulk of our studies tonight from the fourth chapter of Nehemiah. Last week we looked at the first chapter of this book and saw Nehemiah proving to be a good model for us as a man of prayer. That is one of the qualities that really stands out about Nehemiah throughout this book, is his active and effective prayer life. He is one who regularly and successfully went to God with his petitions. And so we were able to study together last week how to pray like Nehemiah, looking at that prayer that is offered when he first got the news in Nehemiah chapter 1 about the dire situation in Judea and how much people there needed help, needed someone to come and assist in the building and the work that they very much had to do that had been left untended for, by this time, generations. Well, tonight I want to continue studying from the book of Nehemiah, but see not how to pray like him, but to follow through on the other primary attribute or primary work, maybe, that we see Nehemiah doing, and that for which he is most famous, which is the building that he accomplished. The work, the dirtying of the hands and getting down with the people, setting himself to a task, laying out a plan for something which was vital, which was necessary for God's purpose, and determining how best they were going to do that, and then, by all means, getting the job done. Do we not have that need today? Do we not have so many things that we must be at work in? So many things that require strength. Families that need to be supported, not with money, not with mortgage payments, not with insurance, vital though those things are. Those families need to be supported with instruction, with rooting and grounding in the truth, with godly leadership. A church that needs to follow the lead of its elders and needs to be supportive of the work and needs to be helping the community of which we are a part. We need to be building the Lord's kingdom, spreading its borders. So many things that require our attention, that require our hard, gritty labor, which is what Nehemiah was so well suited for and is why God chose him for this specific task. Jumping ahead a little bit from where we're going to be taking our study tonight, the report comes in Nehemiah chapter 6, maybe a page over in your Bibles. Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 15 tells us about the work finally being completed, and I just want us to think about this. Tells us in verse 15 of Nehemiah chapter 6 that the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul in 52 days. Here is work that, if you remember the timing we talked about last week, of course for well over 100 years, the people had been in captivity. But it had even been almost 100 years since Cyrus the Great, the Persian king, had told everyone throughout all the kingdom in 538 BC, you can return home. You go back to your ancestral lands. You rebuild your temples. You rebuild your places of worship. You are free to do that. He encouraged everyone to do that, including the Jews. And yet almost 100 years later now, in 444 BC, Nehemiah returns and, well, the temple has been rebuilt after a lot of stops and starts and a lot of work that had been left undone. And yet the town was in rubble. There were burned out buildings. There were portions of the wall that simply didn't exist. It looked like a hopeless thing. And this had been the case for decades. And yet now under this stalwart, godly leadership of Nehemiah, the people really begin to work at what they perhaps should have been doing for quite some time previously, and within 2 months, it's done. Can you imagine some of those people, maybe people who had come back to Jerusalem 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago, and had been looking around at that town for so long and thinking, oh, this is just never going to get done. It's never going to be like it was. We're never going to have defenses. We'll never feel safe here. We'll never be able to get back to anything resembling normal life in this place. It's just so ruined. It's just so devastated. And then here comes Nehemiah, and 52 days later, they're kind of looking around thinking, well, that really wasn't as hard as we thought it would be. I guess it was possible after all. All it needed was someone to get us organized and get us to work, to just actually do the task that was ahead of us. And I also want to pay attention to the effect of that in verse 16. And it happened when all our enemies heard of it and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God. We speak frequently of the warfare that we are engaged in as Christians, that there is an enemy side, that we are fighting against Satan and his agents. We are fighting against the evil of the world. We don't take up physical arms. We don't take up physical weaponry. But we are engaged in spiritual warfare, and there is an opposing side that is trying to thwart us, and we oftentimes commiserate with that and mourn over the fact that we do have this powerful adversary in the world who seems to be so ever-present and seems to be so successful. But look at what happens to the enemy side, the opposition here. When good work is done, when something vital is completed, Nehemiah says, they noticed that and they didn't like it. They were disheartened, and they knew because of that the power of God. The victories that Nehemiah would ensure the people had later would then come much easier. Well, let's look at Nehemiah chapter 4 together and see how this building took place. And again, I think the parallels to our spiritual building come easily, in large part because that seems to be what Nehemiah was chiefly concerned with during this whole time. It might be of interest in chapter 3, for instance, when we see all of the sections that are mentioned of the wall that the people were building upon. The first section that is mentioned is the area in and around the sheep gate. That is the gate that was closest to the temple itself, where the sheep, as you would guess, being called the sheep gate, where those animals would come in and out of the city for sacrifices to be made. It was the area closest to the temple. That seems to be what they worked on first and solidified first. Nehemiah has a mind this entire time to get the people back into a state where they can worship God as they needed to, where they will be strong people of a spiritual mindset. And so we can also build and work like this man and those who were in his charge. Let's read together these first three verses of Nehemiah chapter 4. So it happened when Sanballat heard, and Sanballat is one leader of the enemy coalition arrayed against the Jews at the time, when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren in the army of Samaria and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Well, they had a good laugh at the Jews' expense when they first heard what they were trying to do. Oh, these foolish people, these silly, feeble Jews, defenseless, they don't even know how weak they are, how poor they are, and how hopeless this cause is. What do they think they're going to do? Just wake up tomorrow and that wall is going to be finished? They think they're going to be able to just get those burned out, crumbling old stones that are left from the old wall and set those things up again? They really think they've got a chance in the world at actually completing this work? Tobiah adds on and says, if they can build something, but I tell you what, if just a small little critter runs across that, the whole thing's going to start tumbling down. They're not going to be able to make anything that would actually stand up against anyone. Of course, this report, I'm sure, gets back to the Jews. We learn later on that there was quite a bit of intelligence that was exchanged between the two camps. Seems there were spies or traitors on both sides who could relate what was going on in the opposing camps between the the Jews and those who stood against them as their enemies. We know that Nehemiah, of course, has knowledge of this, whether that was revealed by the Spirit or whether that was just simply common knowledge in the day. It seems to be that it was just something that was a very talked about thing, that these Jews, how silly, kind of the dismissive, how cute of them that they think they're going to actually do this. Oh, it's precious. Look at them work. Like a kid building a sandcastle or out in the front yard, he's going to make some big nice project in the front, building a fort or something. And you know, just the next time there's a storm, the wind is going to knock it down. Oh, it's precious. Look at him work. They have a good laugh at the Jews' expense. Well, they don't let those doubts deter them. They don't let those insults and that ridicule cause them to start second guessing and say, maybe this is foolish. Maybe we are being silly. Maybe we just are powerless. Folks, we understand the work that we conduct today is going to be met with ridicule and might be seeded with doubt, perhaps even from the inside. The world very much wants us to think that we're involved in something foolish. And Satan certainly wants us to think that our efforts are in vain, that we just really can't accomplish anything of note in this world today. Well, you think you're going to build a strong family, he tells us. You know what's going to happen as soon as your kids go away to college. They're going to forsake you. They're going to take that freshman biology class and learn about evolution, and they're going to be out the door. They're never going to go back to a church. They'll desert you. You think you can build this lasting godly relationship with your spouse? That's an antiquated notion. There are no happy marriages anymore. That's fool's gold. The work of the church, what we're trying to accomplish here, Satan says, nobody wants that anymore. Churches aren't growing today. Churches are dying. People are leaving them by the scores. You're not going to be able to build anything that lasts. You're not going to be able to build a solid foothold for the Lord's kingdom in this community. Look at how ungodly all the people are around you. Nobody's interested in that. Don't talk to that person over here about the Scriptures. Don't try to invite your neighbor to come and to listen to the Word of God. Don't see if those people are interested in having a Bible study with you, because you already know they're not. You're just going to embarrass yourself. This doubt, this ridicule that we fear we are going to face on every hand, don't listen to it. Have much the attitude that Nehemiah had in verses 4 and 5. He offers a bit of an aside and simply praying that God would hear that. Hear those who are despising us. Turn their reproach on their own heads. Lord, you listen to what they've done. You remember that. But Nehemiah doesn't pay a lot of attention to it. And none of the people who are working pay much attention to it. They're simply too busy. They have a task at hand. There's no time to be overcome, to be riddled and beset with doubts and insecurity and fearing the ridicule of the world. Put all those things aside. Put all those things out of your mind and simply do the work. And do the work with real zeal and with a strong will. Look at verse 6 of our text in Nehemiah chapter 4. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height. Whether that is telling us that they finished closing all of the gaps, perhaps. Didn't get it yet to the height that they needed. But at least half of the eventual height was finished all around. Might be what that's indicating there. But that work was done, and the wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. How does this get done? How do you actually accomplish it? Because the people wanted to. Because they saw the value in it. Because they set their minds to it. Because this was work that they desired and willed to participate in. We see some of the seeds planted in that mindset back in chapter 2. In chapter 2 and verse 18, when Nehemiah is talking to some of the leaders of the people, another of the great statements in this book, when he told them of all of the success they'd had thus far, that the king had been receptive to his demands in helping to rebuild, that the hand of God had been upon him, When he gave that report to the people, they said, not Nehemiah, the people he's trying to convince to do the work, they said, "Let us rise up and build." And then they set their hands to this good work. We're not going to get very good work done if Ray and Gerald are dragging us to the work all the time. If we have someone who is standing up here who is kicking someone out the door saying, go do work, please, cajoling and threatening and twisting arms and saying, go try to do good things for your neighbor. Go try to speak to people about the Scriptures. And we're just, that's coming from one person, from two people. That's coming from just one person in each family. And that is going to be a strong family. Everyone else is ready to abandon ship and jump off board. But there's one person who's still pulling. Friends, that's not going to be enough. Building takes place only when you have this, people with a mind to work, see the value in the task and want themselves to do it. And are going to do it. Again, without being threatened or whipped into doing so. They simply had a mind to work. That speaks to the will. That speaks to people who see what God has set before them and have decided that they're not going to be obliged to do something. They're not going to be guilted into doing something. They want to. I want to save my neighbors. I want my brethren to be stronger tomorrow than they are today. I want my family to be closer knit and more firmly grounded in Christ. If we want those things, we'll pursue those things which meet the goal. We see this trouble coming up, and it just kind of seems to keep piling up for the Jews who are trying to complete this work. Sanballat and Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites, those are enemies on almost literally every side, every area of the map surrounding the Jews. They have someone who's standing against them in verse 7. When all those people heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. So what happens in verse 9? "Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them we set a watch against them day and night." We won't belabor this point because we spent most of our time on it last week in talking about Nehemiah's useful example as a man of prayer. But it bleeds down into the people that he was leading, doesn't it? What's the very first thing that they do when this opposition comes and when they hear the news that they're maybe going to be attacked, that they we'll see indication later on there in verse 11. Maybe the enemy is planning some sort of sneak attack. They're going to come in cover of darkness and attack the Jews and kill them before they even knew what hit them, before they even recognize that they're there. That's a scary thing. That can be frightening. You have these people who are surrounding you on every side who want you to fail, who want you to be humiliated, who want your work to crumble. What's the first thing that you do in that situation? They didn't panic. They didn't run around in a flurry trying to get everything done quickly so they wouldn't have stuff to worry about and doing poor work as a result. They didn't forget who was actually behind them in this task. The first thing they do before anything else is done, "So we made our prayer to our God." First things first, let's turn this over to the one with ultimate power to help or to hinder. And we will see how he responds. The very first thing in crisis must be falling to our knees and approaching the Almighty God and seeing what He will do for us, with knowledge that He will provide that which is ultimately best. Pray first when trouble arises. Anytime we meet those snags, we meet those difficulties that come up in the work we're trying to do as a church, as individuals, in our families, in our community, pray first when trouble comes up. If I can risk being too metaphorical with this passage that we have, in verse 10, the only indication of any problem that the Jews themselves had was one of physically failing strength. Again, their zeal is not in question. They have a mind to work. But Judah gives the report to Nehemiah in verse 10 that the strength of the laborers is failing, that there's just so much work to do. The men are starting to get tired. And one of the big problems is that there is so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall. Again, remember, Jerusalem is not just a city that they're trying to build. One of these, what do we call them in Houston and in big cities, a master planned community. This is not just some place that was a rice field last month, and now it's a place with an orthodontist and a Whataburger and a nail salon and two schools and a bunch of lakes and ponds and restaurants and all that sort of stuff. And it just kind of springs up within a few months because, well, there wasn't anything there. You didn't have to clear anything out. You just had this plan for exactly what needed to happen. You go in with the bulldozers and with the workers and the builders and the capital, and you just go and get that done. Well, Jerusalem is a city that had been inhabited for hundreds of years, had been destroyed and leveled on at least one recent occasion, and had after that time seen constant fighting. There are burned out buildings. There's rubble lying in the streets. There are all these incinerated stones that are lying there. You're not just building a wall. You're having to fight over the old stuff, the rubbish, as it calls it here. Get past all of that clutter before you can actually begin building what you want to build. That really slows things down, doesn't it? When you first have to get rid of all of the junk. And here it's just causing a problem. It's causing a literal and metaphorical pileup where they just say, there's too much junk lying around first. They need to clear all of that out. In the life of the Christian, in the work of the Christian, he has to get rid of the clutter. We looked at a couple of passages this morning. One in particular, I'm thinking, Ephesians chapter 4. We looked there at the new man, that person who has so learned Christ that he recognizes the teachings of Jesus. He will act in a certain way, and he will put on that new man, which is made according to the image of God. We read in Ephesians chapter 4. Colossians 3 has similar instruction. We would see several other places, in fact, especially in Paul's letters, where ideas like that are found. And we note frequently, and I think with wisdom, that there is in those texts the idea of first putting off the old man and then put on the new man. You don't just add to whatever you are or whoever you are or whatever you're doing the good stuff, the useful stuff, the valuable stuff, the godly stuff. You don't just kind of get the hammer and the nails and just tack that onto the side and say, done. I was a lousy person. I was just running around wild doing whatever I wanted to, but I'm just going to also add to what I am good works. Okay, problem solved. Christian now. I'm not just going to have all these bad habits that I've accrued and that my family has accrued, and I'm just going to continue showing the poor side of myself to my family, where maybe I'm a tyrant at home, or I show an example of laziness and not leading my family, and I'm just going to continue doing all those things, but I'll take them to church every once in a while, or I'll give them a bulletin to read, and I'm just going to do building in that way, just kind of add something to that, supplement it. No, first get rid of the clutter, get rid of the rubble. Get rid of all of the bad habits, all of the bad things, all of the sin that we have to purge from ourselves if we're actually going to build something useful. That seems to be wisdom in building. First, get rid of that which is going to be detrimental, which is only going to get in the way. Several things throughout the rest of this chapter show us the adversity, the real adversity that Nehemiah and these people are facing. Let's begin reading in verse 11. After they decide that the strength is failing because we have a lot of work to do in clearing everything out to begin with. We maybe don't have the number of people that we need. We're just being worked very hard. But the adversaries continue to plot their downfall and their destruction. In verse 11, they said, "They will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease." So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, "From whatever place you turn, they will be upon us." Therefore, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses." And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, "The work is great and extensive, and we're separated far from one another on the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." So we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. At the same time, I also said to the people, "Let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day." So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. We're getting the image here of people who were vigilant in what they might face. The fact that there was an enemy who was out there for them. Even after the report comes back that God has brought the plot against them to nothing, that they've maybe been foiled in that ambush or that surprise attack that they might have been planning, you notice that the people don't say, "Oh, good, well, that's over with. So everybody just kind of don't worry about that anymore. Don't pay attention to yourself." No, he says, "We returned to work, but we were pretty careful." Imagine those working conditions. You've got a spade or a shovel or something in one hand, a pickaxe. And in the other hand, you've got your bow and you've got arrows in the quiver behind you or at your hip. You've got a sword or an axe in one hand. You've always got this weaponry that you're carrying around. And then when you're not on that shift where you're working, you're out standing guard. You're just having to scan the horizon, see if there's anyone out there who is going to be coming for you and for your people. You're staying on guard. You're staying vigilant. Verse 23 tells us about just the constant work that is being done. We get the idea of just really not much sleep going on. There's a reason we did praying like Nehemiah. We're doing building like Nehemiah. I'm not going to do doing laundry like Nehemiah or sleeping like Nehemiah. This is difficult work that they're doing. Say, all right, we're going to stay ready, prepared, dressed, and ready to go at all times. Change clothes every once in a while just so they don't stand up and walk off themselves, those clothes that we've been wearing. But then put them right back on as soon as you're done because you got a job to do. You're either building or you're on watch. That vigilance against the enemy, is that not necessary in the work that we do? Know that there are those who want us to fail. We talked about that some with our first point, that ridicule, that doubt that tries to be sown among us. Recognize that. Be forewarned. Be wise in that. And don't be caught off guard when Satan brings temptation, when your family faces trouble, when the church faces a challenge. Don't act like that's totally unforeseen. Recognize that those challenges are going to come. Have foresight. Be watching the horizon so that you know where those threats might come from, what things you might have to deal with, that we might need to have teaching of this type. I might need to instruct my children against this particular error or temptation that they're going to face. I need to be ready to combat this difficulty that might present itself to the church. Whatever the case might be, we're ready to take up arms. We're ready to go to war when called upon. They had courage. They were not going to back down from the fight. And when the enemy came, everybody was going to scatter. Well, Nehemiah says, you be ready. You've got your weapons on hand there. Make sure you're ready to put them to use. Rally to us when you hear the trumpet. Come and be where the fighting is. And we know that we're going to prevail. The constant confidence that they have because of, as he describes them in verse 14, the Lord, great and awesome, who would fight for them. That's what we must remember at all times when we are engaging the enemy. We have the victory promised to us if we fight on the Lord's side. So be wise, be prepared. Know that adversity is always just right around the corner. Be ready to match it, to fight. The final admonition I would offer tonight is what Nehemiah brings up. We saw some indication of this, first of all, in verse 13, where he sets up the people and orders the workers according to their families. The idea there is probably just by means of organization. They needed to be set up somehow. But don't you think there would be some value for those men who were not just manning the wall alongside strangers, or who were not just walking around with both sword and building tool in hand among some of their acquaintances? But when they consider the work that they're doing, they look and maybe in the house 10 feet away from them near the wall is their home, where their children are inside, where their wives are inside. They know what they're fighting for. They're there alongside their brothers, their fathers, their uncles, their grandparents, their grandchildren. They're among those people there that they know, that they love, that they recognize. We are truly all in this together. I'm not just fighting for myself. As Nehemiah encourages them in verse 4, don't be afraid, remember the Lord, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your houses. You have something on the line here that is not just you. The people you love are counting on you. The people who depend upon you need you to be strong and remember why you are doing what you're doing and to join the battle courageously and without fear. And so that's why he tells them further in verses 19 and 20. We're sort of separated from each other because we're all along this wall that's being rebuilt. You may not be right at hand where I can grab you when I need you to cover my back if the enemy comes. So if they do show up, we're going to blow the trumpet and everybody needs to show up at the same place. Rally to us there and God will fight even in our midst. They're a further consideration for the people that they were working alongside. Someone else, more people who are counting on them. That is absolutely the case when we consider our work, our building. When I make the determination to follow Christ, when I make the determination that I am going to live a godly life, I need to do that for myself, yes. But I also very much need to do that for my spouse, for my children, for my grandchildren, for my nieces and nephews, for the people who are here that I worship with, that I love, that I am involved in edifying and being edified by. Those people count on me, and I count on them. There's that codependent relationship. But I need to remember those people. Remember, fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, your houses. If I fall, I'm not going to just cause harm to myself. I'm going to be damaging those people. We don't say that to scare anyone or to harm anyone. We say that simply to hopefully encourage us to remember the importance. What exactly is riding upon our obedience to God, our stalwart and zealous work in His kingdom? I pray this evening that you have begun a good work, which will be perfected in Christ. And I pray that you are able to do that work in such a manner that, so to speak, 52 days later, you'd be able to say, I'm done. I got accomplished what I needed to. Now, we recognize the work we're doing as Christians doesn't have an end point. We're not building a wall that we can see when it's finished. We're trying to constantly expand and strengthen and fortify. The bad news is that will not be 52 days. It might be 52 years and then some that we need to be involved in this zealous work in God's kingdom. But I pray that we would have that attitude, that spirit that these people had, so that when we see what we need to do, we'll take care of those tasks with the Lord's help, with each other's help, with the correct mindset, and with the will to work, that we would say, this needs to be done, and so I am going to do it. But if you have not begun that work, you have not begun a life that is lived in allegiance to Christ. You're not even a part of one of those work teams yet. Maybe you've just been standing inside the city looking at everyone else doing things. You need to make the decision that you are going to serve the Lord, that you are going to follow Him wherever He would call you, that you're going to be a member of His kingdom, a member of His people. You can do that tonight. And we can assist in your obedience. If you have any such need, let us know. Come forward right now while we're leading this song.